Welcome to the Holden Village Podcast. Holden is a community of education, programming, and worship located in the remote wilderness of the Cascade Mountains. These snapshots provide a glimpse into the learnings taking place in our community. Let's tune in to this week's highlight.
So I'm Sharon Varallo here from Augustana College. I've been at Holden Village a few times in the past. During this session, I've been invited to talk a little bit more about mass incarceration and on the criminal justice system. And I gave a talk in Koinonia last night about the phenomenon of false and coerced confessions, how prevalent they are, how it happens, sort of an inside story of the Reed technique of criminal interrogation, and how both guilty and innocent people can be persuaded by this interrogation technique. This is a technique that gets people to say something. It's not an information gathering technique. It's a compliance gaining technique. It has begun to lose favor. The Reed technique is just starting to be, I think, tarnished enough so that some cities with lucky citizens, their police departments have stopped using the criminal interrogation technique that is not based on any research and is responsible for a lot of innocent people being imprisoned. I live in the Quad Cities, and currently, one of the four Quad Cities has stopped using the Reed technique of interrogation. Some Quad citizens might not be interrogated this way if they somehow find themselves being talked to by police about something, but then others will. This interrogation technique is just one small piece of a much larger puzzle that is of mass incarceration in the United States. It is absolutely a crisis in this country. It is one largely borne by Black and brown families and families who live in poverty and families, for example, who might live in high crime areas, because very often poverty-stricken areas do have high crime. That doesn't mean anything about an individual who might be walking to school. A young man in New York experiencing stop and frisk stopped going to school. And Julie Dresner has a film. It's something about stop and frisk in New York City. And anyway, there are a number of ways. It is very easy to go to prison in the United States. It is very hard to get out. This is from something that a lot of people don't want to believe. It's very easy to think, well, why would you be near trouble if you trouble by association? I mean, there's always a way to say somebody who's in prison sort of deserves to be there. I would really ask people to rethink that. I have many, many stories I'd like to share about that. But what I would most like for everybody to imagine, let's just say that we're not talking about somebody who's innocent. I mean, I came into this area because of an experience of an innocent relative who had been coerced into confessing to a violent crime that she did not commit. It started our family on a hellish cycle that took us years. And we're a family with enough resources to hire a lawyer, who most people don't have that. What we experienced is something that I think everybody should imagine experiencing. That is, imagine someone you love. In my case, my relative was innocent. But even if your knuckleheaded nephew, even somebody who makes a mistake or does something violent or does something on drugs, I mean, whatever it is, imagine someone you love and the worst thing they've ever done, and that becomes who they are. They no longer have a name. They are just called by a number in prison. The person who was wronged very often has no say in the criminal justice system either. And so victims often don't feel restored. They're often not informed. I mean, the process is out of both victim and offender hands. It enters, once there's a charge and then a conviction, it's hard to describe the powerlessness of both victim and offender and all of the myriad loved ones, and employers and neighbors and teachers and friends and love. I mean, all the ripple effects of destruction that come out of being incarcerated pretty easily. I have had people tell me that no, it is not easy to get into prison, that you really have to do offend and offend and offend and offend and offend to get into prison. And I can imagine that in some cases that is true, but it is not always true. It was certainly not true in the case of my family, but good luck getting out. Because of these experiences, I've learned so much and have started studying it and have started learning about the scope of it. And I cannot not speak to it. If we know globally, I mean, most people listening to this probably know that the United States has 5% of the world's population, but 20% of the world's incarcerated population, that we incarcerate more people by far than any other country on earth. We put more people in prison and we put them in for longer. Prison is now normative. It's easier sometimes for a judge to put somebody in prison than not, that very often they'll have to explain why they didn't send somebody to prison. During a conference, I heard someone equate justice currently with time in a cage. And I don't know who that helps. If 20 years in a cage makes somebody better, restores them, it doesn't. It makes them worse. That's not okay. And so knowing that, Jason Wan is a colleague and friend from Augustana College. He and I and another faculty member, Tony Pomalis, started volunteering at our local minimum security men's East Moline Correctional Center. From the very first day, we sat in a circle with men who are interested in taking a liberal arts and college prison class from us, of our own design, non-credit bearing, volunteer. The three of us had three different books, and we it was a pilot program that was designed to help see if courses can help reduce recidivism. Now, the way the program was run, it was good on paper, but it didn't last long enough. But from day one, the three of us were all in. Because what we saw were men who desperately were interested in learning and being better and doing better, taking accountability in many cases, not in all cases. But most of the men that sat in that circle, it was like our presence there was giving them water in the desert. They weren't unaccustomed to even being asked what their names were. They were numbers. The dehumanization that comes along with your loss of freedom is hard to measure in terms of its destructiveness. But I saw men who had been in prison since they were teenagers, now in their 30s, who had managed to become good people inside prison. And that takes some kind of strength. So my eyes were opened.
What were some of the, you said it was open-ended, just liberal arts.
Yeah.
What did they have to say in what they wanted to learn? And I was curious, what was popular?
Yeah. So the first day, we actually had an idea before we went in, but the first day of class, we went around and we got, some little bit of introductory stories. And we asked all the men who had signed up for this program, the kinds of things they liked to read, the kinds of things they liked to learn, and what in particular they were hoping for if they were to take a class. And we just took notes that first day and we tried to incorporate as much as we could. The problem is a lot of folks who are in prison have no idea what college can be or can do, how transformative it can be, what liberal arts is. I mean, we're liberal arts professors. And so we had to you know, take into account we had a wide variety of men with of educational backgrounds among the men who were in that class. And from everyone there was supposed to have a GED. There were a few exceptions, but there were several men with master's degrees. But most people who are incarcerated have very low educational levels. About half the men at this particular facility cannot read. There's a huge need for volunteers to do GED tutoring, to teach people to read. But we're college professors. And so we did what we do. And Jason, for example, Dr. Mon is a religion professor. And he taught a course on vocation. He used the book C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce. And with a class of men who were, you know, are waiting out their term, they read C.S. Lewis together and talked about vocation and the meaning of life and what your skills are and what the world's needs are. And I'm a communication studies professor, but I also teach first year reading. And so my first course was kind of a learning how to learn course. I love to teach first year college students. And there was this book, The New Science of Learning, which my students at Augustana really got a lot out of. And it's basically the neuroscience of learning. And I use that. It's just a slim volume. It's just a little, you know, book, but it's kind of packed full of the neuroscience of why you need to, you know, how you can succeed in college. And I thought, well, let's start out with this to see if this group of men would like to, you know, like, it's helpful to know how important sleep is and how you make memories and how you learn and how, you know, the role of water and exercise. And I mean, some of it physical and a lot of it organizational and, you know, it's a great little book. The men in my class at the prison could not believe that they were reading the same stuff that I gave my Augustana College students. And I had to tell them over and over again, our discussions here in this prison, our discussions here are good. They are good. And this is the same stuff that you're reading there. You are not different from them. One man would say, like, you know, well, I'm sure the discussions you have at college are much higher level than this. These men would read and they would think and they would write notes. They would write that everybody was just, I mean, there was no problem with discussion. When you're volunteer teaching in a prison, you will raise your expectations for your college students because the incarcerated students, they do not take for granted what an education is. And the opportunity to be in a room with people talking about ideas. And one man said, I didn't know I was smart enough to, you know, I just never thought about going to college. I didn't think I could do it. I'm like, he brought it to class. But, you know, if you don't finish high school and you don't know and it wasn't part of your trajectory, how do you know? Michelle Clifton Soderstrom is a professor from North Park Seminary, and she has opened the doors for lots of folks to teach at a maximum security men's facility in Illinois. And she visited as a guest speaker to Augustana. She spoke about the good news. She spoke about the good news of going into a prison and just being there. If you're doing a book club, if you're doing a class, whatever it is, you don't have to teach theology to have your, to have that be quote unquote good news. And I get what she means. I get what she means because when you go in there, there's not a lot of humanity in that system. And it's kind of hard to even imagine. It's hard for me to imagine solitary confinement. It's hard for me to imagine not being called by my name, having strip searches, having all the things that they undergo. It's pretty degrading. So of course you get depressed. Ken Burns, just in 2019, came out with a documentary called College Behind Bars. Just out. It's free, streaming on PBS. You can find it online if anybody wants to see it. in College Behind Bars shows an example of what Bard College does in with a liberal arts in, you know, higher ed in prison program. That is so inspiring to me. And it's something that I think that many of us could do if we just make it happen. It's not, it doesn't seem hard to me. It's, I mean, it is hard because there are lots of bureaucratic barriers and, you know, and money. But honestly, this becomes higher ed in prison is now a bipartisan issue in the United States, and for lots of different reasons, but including financial. It's actually cheaper to send a student to Harvard than it is to imprison them for a year, right? And every dollar spent on education saves $5 in the long run. I mean, there's financial sense, there's humanitarian, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why now people from all ends of the political spectrum are interested in criminal justice reform and hopefully ending mass incarceration.
The thing I keep coming back to is in the feeling of such an inhumane way of living and lack of freedom for perhaps things that they did do or didn't do, and that freedom being taken away, you're providing a balance and a sense of hope and a way to feel freedom through, you know, learning and education in a system that doesn't have hope built in really almost at all, that it's a great way to help that sort of end of the line,
yeah,
and reintroduce or just reinvigorate, give energy to people that are suffering. So what's next for the plan in teaching?
Well, I have ideas. And right after I leave Holden in an hour, after this J term, I'm on sabbatical. And I'll be hopefully writing a grant. I'm definitely writing a grant, hopefully getting it, and designing some ways to encourage current Augustana faculty to go and see if this is for them. Volunteering in a prison is not for everybody. And I would never push somebody who felt like they weren't sure, right? But if I offered an incentive, so I'm thinking now of incentivizing really good faculty to go once to the prison, just go once and give a guest lecture, and I'll give them a stipend and they can find out if it's for them, because that's all it took for me and Jason and Tony was going once. And we were, you see that you're in a room with other human beings who are, again, not different, who love learning.
Yeah, there's a renewed sense of reward, too, as it's so valuable on both ends. As you said, in terms of raising the bar, discussions, and realizing what the prisoners can offer in their perspective, and then for them, seeing possibilities.
Yeah. Yeah, for anyone who's interested, that College Behind Bars documentary is that's kind of my goal. It may be out of my reach out of our reach as just starting a program, but it shouldn't be. It should not be that hard to offer college courses in a prison. If it's transformative for students who start out having resources, imagine how incredibly transformative this education is for students who didn't even know it would ever be possible. It's healthier for their families, because the men in my class are fathers. Many of them are fathers. They have loved ones, and they feel like they're doing something positive, to be a positive role model finally, right? So in some cases they say, you know, it's great to be able to tell my kids that I'm taking a college level class and they can do it too. You know, share the books and have conversation about that. It is very empowering. And frankly, I mean, that's something that a lot of folks who have been to college can imagine. I mean, you can remember a time when you finally, when you figured out, I can do this, right? It's important. I believe in education, and Holden Village is so supportive of the integration of education with mind, body, spirit in the earth. And when you enter a concrete jungle and you literally see human beings in cages, and there's the soul is just stripped out of the space, the procedures are antiseptic. It's not a place for human beings. There are people who are abolitionists, who are prison abolitionists. I don't call myself a prison abolitionist. I'm not one yet. I might be at some point, but I'm not now. And that's because I still think there is a need for prison, and there's definitely horror in the world, and I absolutely believe that. But I refuse to believe that 2.2 million Americans are beyond redemption. Nearly 1 in 10 American children have experienced parental incarceration. A lot of this information is from prisonpolicy.org, if anybody wants to check me. If your parent is incarcerated, loses their job, I mean, so many people are paycheck to paycheck, families that get, I mean, that child's chance at education is extremely diminished. How do you concentrate when you're trying to worried about food or worried about, you know, somebody finding out about your dad or your mom? Or, I mean, kids in these situations, they didn't ask for it, and they can get left behind. So I think it's largely a hidden problem in some communities. In some communities, it's just a norm. I mean, one of the men in my class said, you know, that's people just went to prison. That's just what they did. It's kind of a rite of passage. And this young man, 34, had been in prison since he was 15, getting ready to get out. And he said, he told his family, I do not want you to have a party for me when I get home, because I'm just getting home from prison. I don't want that to be a celebration. I want you to give me a party when I get my driver's license. I want you to give me a party when I, you know, start college. You know, like, give me a party for something pro-social. And because he had grown up seeing people come home from prison and, you know, and being celebrated. And this is a young man who made a terrible mistake in his grief and in his pain. And I don't want to he's taken accountability for what he's done, but he's a human being. And he grew up in a battlefield, and he was like a child soldier in my vision. But this is not a man who should be thrown away. And we can't afford that in this country. We need all the skills and the talents and the humanity of our people. I think about him. I think about, you know, like, who's going to hire him? If you are listening to this and you have a small business, please know, very often when people take a chance on someone with a felony record or a criminal record, your employees are more loyal, right? Often more dependable, because they don't take for granted that they're going to have a job. And I'm speaking in generalities, because of course we can also, somebody I can imagine meeting in class who might mess it up too. But there we are. I mean, they're like all of us. Like, sometimes none of us is perfect.
Yeah, no, I like that. You said that the diversity of gifts, we're not going to be as strong as a whole humanity if we're just denying a segment of society and seeing what they have to offer and putting energy in. Towards them might not seem like an obvious helpful thing to us, but in the long run, obviously it is. Yeah.
In every realm. So I met this this new nonprofit called Die Jim Crow. And the founder was very inspired by Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, which basically says that mass incarceration is the new slavery that it is, you know, and she does a brilliant job in that book. And he is a musician, and he started a nonprofit and they go to prisons recording music. And so music across all genres from incarcerated men and women. And imagine getting access to a prison with recording equipment. I mean, they have to be so, I mean, they are so diligent, so persistent. And this is an act of love and of justice in the arts. And they've got some beautiful music online, and they're going to launch pretty soon, I think 2020. But you can already go and see what Die Jim Crow is about if you're into music. It's inspiring to see what men and women create, even in the dire circumstances that they're in, that they can create music that is incredible. It's just good. Being at Holden is such a blessing, in part because I can bring my whole self here, and I'm just grateful.
Thanks for joining us. Be sure to view the links in the description for more information, or visit our website to find out more about the village. We hope you will make a pilgrimage to Holden. Blessings and peace to you.